That was a segment of a program we aired earlier this year about the stagnant pace of UN climate negotiations. It was produced by Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and Brian has been sticking with the climate beat. He just finished covering the latest round of talks in Durban, South Africa. He joins us now from South Africa so we can get an update on the progress, or lack of progress, towards international action on climate change. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew.
So let's start off with the basics. The press coming out of Durban is a little bit confusing. I'm reading that there was some sort of agreement, but I'm also reading that there wasn't an agreement. So what did you see there? What's your take?
Well, what there was an agreement to make more agreements. So the main quote-unquote breakthrough of these talks was that every country at these talks, including the United States, which has never ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and including China and other large developing countries like India and Brazil and South Africa, which have never been legally bound to cut their growing greenhouse gas emissions, all agreed in principle that they should negotiate something that binds them legally to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. Very unspecific about how much or about when, but they agreed in principle that they should negotiate this agreement by the year 2015 and that it should take effect no later than the year 2020. The reason you're hearing that they didn't really do anything is because they haven't actually put any hard numbers on how much they're going to cut, and science doesn't work on diplomatic timelines. So right before these talks started, the International Energy Agency released a report where they said, look, by the year 2017, on its present trajectory, the world is going to have built enough coal-fired power plants and put enough cars on the road that it will have locked in enough greenhouse gases to take the planet right up to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Now, officially, the goal of these negotiations is to keep the planet's temperature from crossing that point. So if the science is saying we're going to be there by 2017, and the negotiations are saying we're not going to be implementing a deal to more aggressively cut greenhouse gas emissions until 2020, then there is a fundamental gap in ambition between what's happening at the talks and what's happening in the planet's atmosphere.
And I also understand there's been a sort of transformation of blame, at least a lot of fingers being pointed in efforts to shift blame between the U.S., China and India, and other countries. Are you noticing shifting dynamics of who or what are the obstacles to progress?
Well, there's always a certain amount of blame game that goes on at these talks. I mean, here's the basic underlying dynamic. All of the big countries in these talks look at dealing with climate change as something that will likely hurt them economically. In other words, swearing off cheap fossil fuel from coal-fired power plants and gasoline-driven car engines is going to decrease their GDP, it is going to increase unemployment, it is going to make their population unhappy, and that is never good for a politician. They also don't want to be the international pariah who is blamed for spiking the talks. So the negotiators come into these talks looking for the most creative way they cannot agree to anything of substance and also not take the blame for keeping things from moving forward. So the U.S. blames China, China blames the U.S. During this round of talks, because India had concerns about some of the wording in the compromise text that was on the floor very late in the morning at the end of the talks, it looked like India was being set up to take the blame. The reality is the negotiating positions of all these countries leave quite a bit to be desired as far as the science is concerned. The U.S. probably the most of all. And that's for a couple reasons. First is that the U.S. is the largest historic polluter of greenhouse gases. Once you release greenhouse gases, particularly things like carbon dioxide, they're very long lived in the atmosphere. So it's not just a question of how much you're releasing now. When you look at responsibility, the question is how much of what's up there cooking the planet right now did your country put in the air? U.S. is number one, no question. Also, from a per capita point of view, how much we release per person, the United States releases almost four times as much as China, which is currently the world's biggest polluter. So China releases more pollution than we do, but it also has 1.3 billion people living in that country. And the third reason is that the United States is the wealthiest country in the world, which means the United States has the most capacity to deal with climate change. It has the most excess wealth to put into developing solar power and wind power and other alternative energy sources. It has the most capacity to make that transition. And the idea is that when the wealthy nations go first, when the responsible nations go first on dealing with climate change, when they put the money into research and development and deployment, then those renewable clean energy technologies get cheaper for the rest of the world because they're already being mass produced for the world's largest market, which is the United States.
So most likely it sounds like we won't see anything come out of this process until 2015, and that's at the earliest. What are the next steps for climate justice activists in the meantime?
I think that's actually a real dilemma for climate justice activists because it's very easy for them to rally outside of these talks against what they perceive as a bad deal, something that's not ambitious enough, something that introduces what they call false solutions, like expanded carbon markets to deal with the pollution problem. But it's another thing entirely to push ahead with your own agenda when you don't really have a platform to do it. You have some people calling for trying to set up international tribunals of companies and countries that are responsible for polluting, but there's not really a legal framework to do it, so that would be purely symbolic. The other question is really, how much can these civil society organizations do? How much traction can they get organizing in their own country? And you can point to places around the world where there have been citizens' campaigns that have made real inroads against fossil fuel consumption. In the United States, this year, very militant round of direct actions in Washington, D.C., seemed to help shut down the Obama administration's plans to greenlight the Keystone XL pipeline that would move oil from the incredibly polluting tar sands in Canada to the market in the U.S. That seems to have spiked that project at least until the end of the election year. In Ecuador, activists there convinced their government to actually leave a large amount of oil in the ground in the Yasuni Reserve, which is good news for the indigenous people living there, good news for the rainforest. And because Ecuador was able to basically line up international donors to give it money for leaving the oil in the ground, it's been a relatively good thing for the Ecuadorian government as well. There's certainly been some victories in oil-rich countries like Nigeria in shutting down oil production in some places. But then you have to ask yourself, well, if you have these limited victories in certain parts of the world, what's the overall impact when all Saudi Arabia has to do is turn the faucet open a little bit wider?
How would you compare this conference to Cancun in 2010 and Copenhagen in 2009? I'm wondering, as the deadlines we've heard about come closer, the dates by which climate change will be irreversible, is there more of a sense of urgency in the hallways and in the conference sessions, or is it the same sense of frustration and the same conversations repeated over and over again?
You know, the finger pointing is definitely the same thing you see every year, but I think there are a couple things that are different. The first one is that the United States was not in the driver's seat at these talks. The compromise language that ultimately was what passed at the talks was something that had been introduced by Europe. Europe seemed to do most of the negotiating, most of the one-on-one meetings that it took to get that compromise language through. And the United States came to these talks basically sounding very, very out of touch. Their line during the first week of talks, when they were briefing the press, was that we're happy with what we've got. We're happy with the all-volunteer arrangement that was put together at Cancun. And they didn't seem to expect that the 193 other countries at the talks were going to expect any more out of the United States. And they basically got an earful from everyone else there. And I think the Obama administration went into this round of talks knowing that this was an election year with basically two priorities. One was not to commit to anything that right-wing Republicans could grandstand on at home as they ran for congressional seats or ran against President Obama. And the second was not to completely blockade the talks so that the United States became an international pariah. In order to avoid becoming an international pariah, the United States did have to agree that, in principle, at some point, it's going to be legally bound to do something about its greenhouse gas emissions. Now, the ultimate language is very vague, But in principle, it is a change in the political landscape. And I think it's significant that the United States was not in the driver's seat on the final deal, as it was at the last two talks.
Brian Edwards-Tiekert just finished covering the UN Climate Negotiations Conference in Durban, South Africa. Thanks for speaking with us, Brian.
Thank you, Andrew.
Early next year, Brian will be producing an in-depth report for us on what happened in Durban, and you can hear his award-winning two-part documentary titled Climate Change Gridlock, Where Do We Go From Here? That's on our website, radioproject.org.